Hello, everyone. Welcome back to this new podcast, How to Do Things with Games. This is my first interview to talk about Wittgenstein, which I'm very excited about. And my guest today, and I'm going to butcher the name, is Janne Arhoranta, something kind of like that.
Close enough.
Well, why don't you tell us how to say your name, and then can you tell the guests a little bit about yourself, and especially since this is this fun new thing in the world, how you came to be, you know, working in game studies?
Absolutely. So I'm Janne Arhoranta, and no worries. It's not like most people need to learn how to pronounce Finnish names. So I do game studies. So what I usually do is I combine some kind of philosophy with things learned about games from other disciplines, and I try to make sense of things. So in practice, I'm a senior lecturer in contemporary culture, which doesn't say anything about games, but the games are kind of a big part of that. So I'm originally studied philosophy. I did a master's in philosophy. And during that time, I was kind of interested in games. So I ended up doing first a bachelor's thesis on play, Gadamerian play, more specifically. And then I did a master's thesis on games. And I had no idea what I was doing, but it was so very, very interesting. And during that time, I found out that there's this thing called game studies, which barely existed back then because this was some time ago. But fortunately, after my master's thesis, I wasn't like sure what to do with all these things about games. But I found a professor who was working at the same university as I did. And he was known to be a game studies person. So I asked whether I could start working as a doctoral student with him. And fortunately for me, that was a yes. And then I started working in game studies, mostly applying things I learned from philosophy into making sense of games. And the first thing I had to do was to kind of read up on what game studies is, because there were no courses back then, so I just like had to learn everything from the beginning.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I as I'm getting interested in game studies myself, obviously with this podcast, a lot of this came from this conversation I had with the philosopher T. Nguyen, and he said that game studies is much better developed in Europe than in the United States. So it seems like, as I'm surveying the field, that Europe is the place to be.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree, although there are definitely places in the US where some very high profile game studies has been done. Like, for example, Ion Bogost is well known in game studies circles.
Yes, of course.
Yes.
Yes, he's the one name that always comes up. Insofar as there is plumbing for game studies, insofar as there is a shared language, at least in the United States, he seems to be where people are drawing it from.
Let's see if that stays true for long. I have a sense that this book might have made some waves, and maybe that will be the book to read in the future.
Yes. Look, that's in part of this project is just thinking that T's book is a book that you can use as plumbing, use as a starting point for game studies. So yes, that's kind of what I am working from as well, from that premise. Very, very excited to eventually, I haven't had a chance to publish that interview yet on my other podcast, but I'm very excited for that to come out. All right. Shall we move on to Wittgenstein? Are you ready?
Yes, absolutely. So do you want to start by looking at him general, or Where should we start?
Yeah, let's say, I mean, first I should just say, maybe before we go on, that you wrote just a wonderful article about Wittgenstein and games. That was how I found you. I think it came out about a decade ago. It's called, what, Defining Games or Game Definitions of Wittgensteinian Approach. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about right. I wrote a bit later, I wrote a different article kind of a more of a applied, like if you don't care about philosophy, but you want to make sense of games and how these definition things work, then I also have a paper like that.
Wonderful. Well, I'll put links to both of them in the listen notes. But yeah, before we get to games and Wittgenstein and your works on games, can you tell us a bit about Wittgenstein? He's someone I'm very interested in, and as we were speaking, has a sort of legendary life. He sits very strangely in the field of philosophy. He's neither continental nor analytic, or both, and maybe he's not a philosopher. All sorts of things. So anything you want to share with people who maybe are not very familiar with Wittgenstein?
Yeah, sure. He definitely had a interesting life, to put it shortly. And he was maybe a kind of a complicated person. To give you an idea of what time frame we're talking of, he was born in 1889 in Austria. So we mostly work in the early 20th century. He happened to be born to one of the wealthiest families in Europe, and he was Jewish, but interestingly went to the same school as Hitler as a child, which is one of those weird details about his life. He also had a complicated family life. Three out of four of his brothers committed suicide. And Wittgenstein, we're talking Ludwig Wittgenstein here. So he was also seriously depressed and contemplated suicide and had issues with mental health during his life, which also meant that he kind of felt that academia wasn't working for him multiple times during his life, and for example went to volunteer into World War One, became a teacher, gardener for a monastery, contemplated about becoming a monk, and eventually became a porter at a hospital, and so kind of did all these things besides working on philosophy. During the First World War, he was a prisoner of war and got a Medal of Heroism, but also described himself as a coward, which is an interesting contradiction. But he didn't come to philosophy like a very traditional way. See? So he originally studied mechanical engineering and was working on aeronautics. So he was doing the mathematics needed for kind of calculating some of the kind of airflows and stuff like that related to that, and became more interesting in the mathematics while doing that, and eventually kind of got into the philosophy of mathematics side of things. So he did maybe not a very obvious thing today, but he just went up to Frege, who was well known at the time, but he wouldn't become his kind of advisor. Instead, Frege sent him to Cambridge to study with Bernard Russell. And Russell had this very kind of conflicting experience with Wittgenstein, especially in the beginning, and found him kind of weird and irritating and thought he might be like a crank. But then eventually decided that no, this man must be a genius, and agreed to kind of be his advisor. There's also other kind of details about he spent a lot of time working in solitude in Norway, writing philosophy, and learned Norwegian during that time, but seemed to hate everyone there. So seems like he might have been the happiest when he was kind of alone in a cabin somewhere off a small Norwegian village or something like that. But he's kind of, besides his kind of weird personal life, he's known for kind of two phases of being a philosopher. So you talk about the early Wittgenstein and the late Wittgenstein. And the both of these kind of can be kind of identified with a book. So there's two books, only one of which was published during his lifetime. So this is the Tractatus Logico Philosophicus. And this was written by Wittgenstein while he was living in Norway in solitude. And it has this like a weird structure where there's three kind of seven main propositions, each with sub-propositions, and those have their own sub-propositions. So you can kind of read it as a list of seven claims and then look at the each of the claims and see what the sub-propositions are there and kind of try to make sense of it. But it's very technical and uses logical symbols and stuff like that. But the basic argument is kind of that limits of language are the limits of philosophy. He kind of argues that the most things like metaphysics or ethics or religion cannot be discussed in any way that makes sense. And probably the best known kind of part of that book is the last proposition, which is in English, it's translated as whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. And he kind of wrote that, decided that, okay, philosophy problem solved, just be silent on these things, and went to teach in a school in Austria, where he lived a very simple life and refused all money from his rich family. And eventually he kind of did return to philosophy. He went to see like a mathematician talk about something at the university and kind of got thinking that maybe this was not the solution to all problems in philosophy. The early part of his life is kind of early Wittgenstein and Tractatus. And then when he comes back from his kind of stint as a school teacher, you get late Wittgenstein, where he goes back to teaching and thinking and eventually writes a manuscript that is kind of a basis for the book Philosophical Investigations, which is also known as, which wasn't published while he was still alive. It was only published 2 years after his death. And that one, I think there are probably people who still read the Tractatus, but most philosophers read Philosophical Investigation because it's considered one of the most kind of important philosophical works of the 20th century. And it kind of has a similar topic as the first book because it deals with language, but it has some very different kind of conclusions, and even the structure of the argument is very different. So it's written differently. There's no logical formalism, but more like a dialogue that Wittgenstein is having with someone, the reader probably. And the basic premise of that book is that the meaning of words is their use. So the words have different meanings in different language games, which is what Wittgenstein calls these different contexts of use. And this is kind of written as an alternative, for example, to thinking that the words are defined by something like mental representations or relations to the objects the words refer to or something like that. And basically this second book had an even bigger effect on philosophy than the first one, especially in like philosophy of language, but also other fields of philosophy. And there's also kind of related stuff in the book, like arguments about the impossibility of private language. There's rule following, which becomes a big thing for especially Saul Kripke, who reads that part of Philosophical Investigations and kind of claims that it's kind of the main argument and forms a skeptical argument about the, well, it becomes its own thing. But the kind of the words mean what they mean because they, of how they are used is kind of the main thing taken away from that book in most cases.
Okay, I think that's fantastic. I think I might assign this in future classes as my introduction to Wittgenstein. So my students will be forced to listen to this. I want to say a couple of quick things before we get to games and your work. So first of all, it seems to me that you can describe both Tractatus and Philosophical Investigations as kind of game-like things. Tractatus is like a puzzle, like a difficult mathematical puzzle. And Philosophical Investigations, as you say, it's a dialogue with the reader, but also large parts of it seem to be missing. So they're almost both puzzles, but from completely different angles. This is my game, philosophy as game angle. I wanted to see what you thought about that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Wittgenstein definitely has this sort of kind of trying to figure out a puzzle approach to philosophy. Tractatus is like this kind of a mathematical puzzle trying to form the perfect answer that would solve everything. And then when he later figured out that, okay, maybe this doesn't work, he kind of writes the second book in a very different where it's like you are taken on a journey where he kind of gives you hints on what to think about and then kind of presents different angles. And maybe there's even different kind of narrators working in the same book. And eventually you're supposed to realize that, okay, this is kind of all building the same argument. And maybe you're supposed to argue some points and kind of disagree with some and it does become this kind of a this like puzzle, like more of a like a like the puzzle that I don't know, the Gollum asks from from Bilbo in Lord of the Rings, like that type of puzzle than a mathematical puzzle like the first one.
Yeah, I'm also struck. So here's a crazy take. I told you I was going to go off script. It almost feels like a role-playing game in that you are asked to you read Wittgenstein's book and then you have to sort of play this character who is talking to and arguing with Wittgenstein. And if you're not willing to play that character, just the way like one of those RPG books can be fun to flip through, but is inert if you don't play it. I feel like you have to play Philosophical Investigations. And when I give it to my students, they say like, well, what is he saying? And I say like, it's not what he's saying. It's what you're saying in response to him. I don't know. Philosophical Investigations as role-playing game book. How ridiculous is this claim?
It's maybe not exactly a role-playing game in a very classic sense, but I do get what you're saying. And there's definitely that kind of back and forth process of kind of going through the scenario that Wittgenstein is kind of giving you.
Going through Wittgenstein as dungeon master.
Like he seemed like a very, I don't know, a demanding person. I'm not sure I would want to play with him if he were there, but at least it would be interesting.
Yes, wonderful. Okay, so it seemed just obvious to me as you were talking through how this applies to games. I mean, obviously the main term that emerges from this probably is language game, and then rule following. If the key thing of Wittgenstein's philosophy is rule following and games have rules, it just seems so obvious to me how Wittgenstein relates to games. But I thought I'd give you your chance now for you to do this work, especially, you know, if you want to talk about definitions, which of course Wittgenstein's opposition to all generality, as Mary Midgley puts it, or his supposed opposition to all generality, seems to me to be sort of the starting point that you're working with.
Yeah, that's definitely, there's the rule following problem, which is fascinating, but perhaps not the kind of the one I've applied the most, because I originally came to kind of applying philosophy with Wittgenstein to game studies for kind of two quite practical reasons. Because I remember starting out in game studies reading other people writing about games and how they kept writing these game definitions and arguing about them. And I remember thinking that the definitions in most cases were not, let's say, not great. And most of people working in game studies are kind of, they come from different disciplinary backgrounds, and they're definitely like overlap between fields, and it's a very multidisciplinary field, but most of them have not been trained in philosophy. So I thought that they were kind of running into problems that were already familiar to philosophers, and kind of thought that applying some Wittgensteinian thinking to the game definition problem would maybe help clarify some of the discussions that were, to me, getting a bit kind of odd or complicated or not very clear.
So I'm going to jump in here and say, this is Mary Midgley's metaphor of plumbing is what she would say is clogged, is they yes. don't have the tools of philosophy, so their thinking is clogged. So if we use Midgley's metaphor, then your intervention is use, you know, Wittgenstein as plumber to unclog the thinking in game studies, which I just find this an ideal metaphor.
Yes, I do like the thinking. It's like there was a leaky pipe somewhere and people yes. kept trying to fix it. But because the pipe itself was the wrong shape, they were doing a like very successful in fixing the leak. So I thought I could do some plumbing myself and kind of try to fix this problem. I didn't know this metaphor for a, like until recently when you showed me the paper, but I had thought of this in slightly different terms, because I was kind of familiar with the work of construction. My dad worked in construction, so I was thinking that I was building kind of this scaffolding so the actual construction can work. So that's a slightly different metaphor. Maybe the Midgley one is better, but I was definitely thinking in similar terms.
So we use, I don't know if this is true in Finland as well, but the word scaffolding is used constantly, both when people are talking about teaching and about making ideas, doing work. Let me tell you, I like the word scaffolding. I found it unfortunate how frequently it's used, because it's one that I used frequently, and now that everyone is using it, it seems to have lost some meaning. The reason why I like plumbing, though, like scaffoldings to me suggest that game studies is a building, and we're going to build it, and if we do the scaffolding now, there's going to be a building sort of built inside of the scaffolding that we made. And then if we want a new building, I guess we have to tear it down and build up a whole new building. Each of us can be plumbing sort of our own regions, and then they can sort of connect or not connect. It's the plumbing is happening underneath game studies and yeah. leaves room for game yeah. studies to sort of spread out. And maybe we'll turn the water off to some of this plumbing at some point, but we don't all have to build the building inside the scaffolding that Yona and T and Graham put together. We can all be plumbing different things. That's why I like this one, even though foundation would have been the metaphor I used, foundation or scaffolding, before I found Midgley's metaphor.
I agree. I'm going to switch metaphors going forward and talk about plumbing.
Wonderful. If this show does nothing else, getting people to read some Mary Midgley on plumbing has been an accomplishment. I'm thrilled.
So the second answer to your earlier question about using Wittgenstein was actually, while reading these papers people wrote about game definitions, I kept running into this claim that when kind of going through the previous literature, they would like quickly mention that. And also there was this famous philosopher Wittgenstein who said that you cannot define games. And I was like looking at that and thinking, wait, that's not right. Like, that's not what Wittgenstein means. That's like a misunderstanding. And because it kept coming up again and again, I thought like I could do maybe two things at once, like maybe get people some tools to kind of work on their game studies problems by doing some plumbing, and then also kind of defend the honor of good old Wittgenstein against these people talking bad things about him. So I kind of thought that this could be helpful for game studies going forward. So the idea, of course, that you can't define games is not what Wittgenstein is saying. It's that it's more like we have these many language games, and the definition of games depends on the language game you're using. And getting this idea to game studies is a big part of what I've been doing.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Do you want to? I mean, the way that I elaborate on this often with my students is one of these little puzzles. They're almost like Zen. I don't know if Wittgenstein knew Zen. That's something I'm going to have to think about. Is he says, you know, suppose you tell me to teach the children a game, and I teach them gambling with dice. Craps is what we call it, at least in the States. I don't know if that's its formal name. And you come back and you say, no, that's not what I meant. And Wittgenstein, the bad kind of philosopher, I would say, the mathematical philosopher, would say, I can define a game, and craps is a game, and that is the answer. So the philosopher is confident that he has defined the game correctly. But every person knows that you don't teach children craps. That's just not a thing, because it's a different, you're using it in a different context. And so Wittgenstein is not saying you can't define games, but he's saying that you should know. And if you don't know, I can explain to you that when you define a game for the purposes of teaching six-year-olds, craps is not in that definition, even though from Bernard Suits's perspective or Bertrand Russell's perspective, craps is a game in some all-seeing universal way.
We get a slightly easier time here in Finland running into that problem, because we have separate words for games children play.
Yes.
And other
games.
That's
amazing. I didn't know that. This does solve this problem, doesn't it?
Well, kind of. But you also run into, like, adults can also play different kinds of games.
Is football a game children play? Like,
No. Okay. It's the distinction is roughly children play plays, or kind of the game they play are on the spectrum of play to game, closer to the play end of the spectrum. So we would say that they, perhaps using other terminology, they would do paideia, not ludus.
Yes.
So we have a word for that.
So I'll let us get back to Wittgenstein in a second, but I just want to say this is, at least in English, a huge challenge. It's a challenge to Suits. It's a challenge to lots of people. The Suitsian definition of games does not include children playing house, or rather some like 40% of that book, if not more, is him attempting to make children playing house fit his definition, which it may or may not. I think also of this quote I used in Rorty, where Rorty says, when you're doing analytic philosophy, if you come up to a problem, just make a distinction. And so if you could just say like, oh, but there's two different types of games, and I'm talking about the first one, and playing house is the second one. That's how Rorty says an analytic philosopher should solve this problem. And he says, this isn't helpful, except that it gets you out of the corner. Now you don't have to worry about house. Suits went in the corner, and man, does he stay in that corner for a long, long time. I feel like he got trapped in that corner.
Exactly. I love his book. It is one of my favorite books of all books ever. But I think he's wrong. It is a joy to read, even though he happens to be wrong on that one point.
Excellent. All right, shall we? I interrupted you. Do you have more to say about Wittgenstein and definition? Shall we talk about family resemblances?
Sure. Maybe I can say one more thing about like where we were at in game studies at the time I was kind of trying to figure this problem out. So there was this kind of tendency during that time to write certain types of papers, like list these qualities and say that I have listed now all the qualities that make games. Therefore, this is a definition of games. And kind of these type of papers, you can still find plenty of them. And they were kind of trying to find these essential qualities that define things as games. And I also found that approach problematic because, well, the essentialism implied there didn't really work for me or work well for explaining what type of phenomena games are as a kind of a large cultural phenomenon. You don't get very far if you start on that road. Or maybe you get where Suits ended up in the corner, and yeah. that's about it. So, of course, language games are kind of the solution I suggest there.
I mean, one thing that I was sort of struck by in some of your work is you've said that, you know, Wittgenstein is writing about language games, but he's not really a scholar of games. He's a scholar of language. I'm a little skeptical of this. I find them... To me, game is neither the example that Wittgenstein uses, although it's telling that he uses it as almost every example in his book is games. Like, that is just telling to me. Nor would I say that games is a metaphor. It seems to me that game is constitutive. I don't think, like, it's the example. It's more like the signifier and the signified. Like, games, language is a game. Games are language. So in that sense, I would, maybe this is just a useless distinction, but it seems to me that Wittgenstein finds language impossible to study outside of games. And so I would call this is, again, a claim that's a little outlandish, a book in the field of game studies, because I don't think it's a coincidence that all the examples are games. I think what games are is actually the crux for Wittgenstein of his turn from this kind of isolated game that he's playing, this mathematical game in Tractatus, to this open to the world game that he's playing, which we can call, if we want to, language. We could also call it philosophy.
Sure. I in this safe space, I wouldn't disagree with that. Maybe when usually I talk about these things, I emphasize the fact that, okay, this is not a game studies book. Stop talking about Wittgensteinian ideas about games, because I want the scholars reading Wittgenstein to notice that it's a claim about language. Also about games, but okay, we can not talk about that for a while, because that leads people doing game studies thinking mostly in terms of how games work. And I want them to realize that, okay, you need to take this language aspect into account in how you think about game definitions, or you're just doing what Suits did, but just badly, probably.
Yes, that is that. It seems like we are in complete agreement then. That's fantastic. So I thought one of the things I wanted to do in these episodes, lest they just lapse into philosophy, and I did mention role-playing games and craps, is can you use this approach to talk about, you know, some games or a game? How can we bring this away from this very abstract concept of a game, which I have suggested for Wittgenstein is also constitutive of human existence in some way? Which Hausinger says is no good. That'll be a thing. And Hausinger says you can't call everything a game. That means that there is nothing that is a game. And we'll see about that pretty soon. So when you want to talk about games using Wittgenstein, how do you do it? How would you talk about a game or a group of games?
Well, I was thinking that a good example could be to talk about a genre of games. So walking simulators.
Ah, yes. Excellent.
So that's like if you're not if you're listening to this and not familiar, it's like games like Dear Esther, Gone Home, Vanishing of Ether Carter, Firewatch, Kentucky Route Zero. It was originally used in this pejorative sense. Like, these are just walking simulators. You don't do anything, you just walk around. But it was kind of eventually embraced by fans of these people of as a kind of genre signifier. And it is kind of typical to these games that there's limited possibilities for interactions and limited amount of challenge, or maybe none at all. And a good example of this is Proteus, which is roughly around this time, like 2013, I think. So in it, there's just like simple pixel graphics, some sounds, nice kind of this audio environments. There's no goals, there's no challenges, no narrative. You just walk around this island, enjoy the view, listen to the sounds. And one of the reactions to this was that this is not a game. It is just a walking simulator. There's no, like, there are some features that are lacking. And because those are lacking, it is no longer a game because those features are essential to being a game. And I kind of disagree because games don't have essential features. There's kind of nothing to lack. There's different language games that have different qualities, but there's no kind of one gameness that all games would need to be like to be like real games. So Proteus can be a game because it kind of fits into this idea of what you do in some games. And maybe it's not very challenging, but that doesn't matter because not all games need to be challenging. So you would kind of use different language games and different kind of criteria to estimate games based on what type of games there are. Like if you talk about baseball or Gone Home or Call of Duty, they can all be games in different ways.
Yeah, that's excellent. I don't know if this discourse happens. Well, I mean, I obviously you have plenty of the English internet over there, but in at least the American internet, a big debate that breaks out from time to time is a hot dog a sandwich? I don't know if you're familiar with this one.
There's the unified theory of what do you call it, of breadness or something,
yes,
like that.
Exactly. And whenever my students bring this up and they love it, I'd make exactly the move you just say, this Wittgensteinian move, which is to say a hot dog is not a sandwich, at least in the United States, because we have a section for sandwiches and then there's a section for burgers and hot dogs, and they're different sections. So you must know when you are making a menu not to put the hot dog in the sandwich section, but that doesn't mean there's some essential breadness that a hot dog has. And we cannot go on this quest for the ultimate truth of whether a hot dog is a sandwich. You simply must know that to make a good menu, the hot dog does not go in the sandwich section. And then, of course, you can put the hot dog in the sandwich section if you want to, but then you're playing a different language game and you risk not being able to be understood by the people who don't know why hot dog is in the sandwich section. In the same way, if someone goes to the Steam store and downloads a walking simulator like Proteus, and then their friend says, "What are you playing?" And they respond, "Oh, I'm playing Proteus. It's this really fun game." It would take a truly asshole friend or perhaps a philosopher to respond by saying, no, you're not playing a game. Walking simulators are not games. You are wrong. That's what I take that Wittgenstein to be guarding against.
Exactly. I think there's a kind of a form of power use in doing that move. Like, you're not playing a real game. Yes. You're playing something else. So whatever I play is real games, and I'm a real gamer playing real games, and you're just walking around on an island listening to nice sounds.
Yes, and this is why in my opening episode I've talked about how I am, you know, at least in the Anglo-analytic sense, not a philosopher or even against philosophy, because I take that as to almost like a colonizing project. They wish to claim ownership of our experience, and they wish to say, I have defined what blank is, what a game is. I've got all these nice rows. There's even some symbolic logic that you can't read because you're a petty humanities person, and now you know that you are not playing a game, even though you think you are playing a game. And if that's what philosophy is, I am against it. But I don't think that's what philosophy is, and neither did at least the later Wittgenstein.
Yes. I'm afraid that maybe the early Wittgenstein would have disagreed with you and maybe been a bit of an asshole about it. Yes. But maybe the later one wouldn't.
That is my reading as well. Excellent. I've got, before I ask you a little bit more about yourself and your institution, I've got just one more question, which is, can we extend this plumbing metaphor in terms of, you know, one of the things Midgley says is plumbing connects to other things. Is there something else that Wittgenstein should connect to, something else in game studies or something in game studies that he doesn't connect to? That I'm, again, you're the first person, so I'm just trying this out, but I thought I'd see what happened.
Well, at least you mentioned, I think, in the first episode, and I referred to, you mentioned Foucault, and I just mentioned the example of how that kind of definition work is also power use. Mm. So I think there's a connection there where if we kind of acknowledge that game definitions are kind of forms of using power, saying that, okay, this counts and this does not count. It is similar to what you discussed in the first episode about how some forms of continental philosophy don't count as philosophy. Mm. Then if someone is like, okay, those are not games, we don't study them in game studies. So our game definitions do have like a big impact on what gets to count as games. For example, if we think that challenge and rules are very important, then maybe we kind of ignore free form play, and maybe we shouldn't. And even if you kind of follow Foucault on the kind of road to understanding power, that he says something like that all knowledge has power effects, even true knowledge. So even if we are kind of pretty sure that games are defined like this, then that does have kind of effects on what counts as game studies. There's a very practical example of this. If you happen to know the international, I guess mostly European, Association for Games Research, it's called Digital Games Research Association. Yes. And not Games Research Association. So there's a definite kind of distinction made there, and some people are quite unhappy about this because it means that, well, for example, studying live action role-playing games or Dungeons and Dragons doesn't count because it's not digital games.
Yes, look, I've already encountered this when I first showed up at UNC, or returned to UNC as a faculty member because I got my PhD there as well. And I found out about this game studies program. I was like, oh, this is so exciting. Let's talk about Settlers of Catan. And they said, well, you know, you can do that, but none of the classes are set up to study tabletop games. So I've created a class called Tabletop Games. And that was just, I play video games. I like video games and tabletop games. But when I hear the word games, for whatever reason, the first thing I think of is Euro games, modern board games. And clearly my undergraduates here in the United States, there's plenty of them that love board games, and the class filled up. But when they hear critical game studies, it is video games. That is their assumption. And then lingering behind this, I am interested. I must admit, I'm not sure I'm allowed to say this on a philosophy podcast. I like watching and playing sports. And yes. I just, you know, it seems to me that the philosophers, for the most part, would rather talk about chess than football, association football. Of course, I don't care for American football. And I want to talk about cricket and CLR James and all of these things. And as near as I can tell, there's a surprising amount of integration of sports and games studies, but I certainly could have imagined there not being that kind of integration. And it does seem to me to be a power question. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that it is also a bit of a problem with the how the personal tastes of game studies people are guiding what we study, like the not just sports, but games about, like, digital games about sports, like football games,
FIFA
is one of the most popular games ever, but is not studied very much because, well, game studies people don't like those type of games.
Yes. that is fascinating. Wonderful. You've given me so much to think about moving forward. The last thing I just wanted to ask you about, since you are at a place where games are studied, and I want this to serve as a primer for philosophy of games primarily, but also to a certain extent for an introduction to game studies. So can you tell us a bit about how game studies works at your institution?
Sure. So I work at the University of Jyväskylä, which is one of the many universities we have in Finland. And we have a research group that is focused on games there, but we also collaborate with other Finnish universities, especially Tampere and Turku, which are kind of one of the bigger universities. And we have this thing together called the Center of Excellence in Game Culture Studies, which means that we more or less work together as one big research group, kind of split geographically a bit, but often kind of collaborating together. And we do many types of research on games, like just in Jyväskylä, we study esports, game streaming, game writing, game addiction, fandom, music, pedagogy, and all kinds of studies. Together, kind of these three universities, the Center of Excellence, it's roughly like 40 researchers currently. So it's I think in international scale, even this is kind of a big group of game studies people, and it's been a real pleasure being able to work here.
All right, wonderful. Well, that is so interesting. I'll have to be on the lookout for conferences or something along those lines. I'm fascinated to learn about this. I had no intention to be in game studies. I was hired back into my old English department to teach mostly composition. And then they said, can you teach classes in games? And I thought, well, I can play games, and I've read Wittgenstein. So yes. And so here I am. We don't have anything like that here at UNC, but I'm hoping to build it. And I could not have asked for a better first interview. Thank you so much. This was so illuminating, Jonna. I'm sorry, I still can't say your name, but I really appreciate this.
Thanks. It was fun to talk about these things.
All right. Wonderful.